Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Really excited to welcome Jim Mitchell to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Jim is the assistant coach and offensive coordinator at Princeton University. Jim and I have become pretty good friends over the last number of years. And Jim, I could not be more fired up to talk lacrosse with you, man. How you doing?
Great, Jamie. Thanks for this opportunity. Pumped to spend time with you on this podcast, one that I've listened to for hundreds of hours over the past few years.
It kills some solid drive time, doesn't it?
No doubt.
Yeah, great. Well, listen, I'm really excited to talk about a lot of different stuff, including the fact that you are also the offensive coordinator and assistant coach for the PLL Cannons. So that should have been probably part of your intro, but fired up to talk college lacrosse, Princeton lacrosse, principles-based offense, constraints-led approach, PLL lacrosse. It's going to be fun. But let's kick it off here a little bit with talking about your lacrosse journey. How did you get here? Give us a quick elevator ride speech on how you got here, and then we'll circle back to all of that as it relates to what you've learned and how you've developed and all the different roles and responsibilities and mentors you've had along the way.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, I think I have a little bit of a unique background, which I'm proud of. You know, I think it's really helped shape where I've gotten to. But I started playing lacrosse a little bit later than most in middle school. I got to go to a friend of mine, took me to a Wings game, which was incredible. That was my first, so when the Gates were there and Mark Millen, it was my first experience watching lacrosse. So I had to do it. Played all sports growing up and fell in love with lacrosse. At the time, my high school, Central Bucks West, did not have a lacrosse program, but we had a dominant football program. So if I wanted to play lacrosse, I would have had to go somewhere else. But football was sort of the main thing at that time in my life. But in that process, we started the program. So it was a club program. By we, I mean a group of really dedicated people in the area helped put it together. And at first it was a club program, and then my senior year, became an official varsity sport at my high school, you know, competing in the PIAA and everything. So that was awesome. That was my first experience. And I played at St. Mary's College, Division III school under Jamie Block, a great mentor and leader. We were a pretty successful program down in the South. We could not get through Salisbury like many others, but a really good experience for me, which sort of kickstarted my college coaching career with an opportunity to be a grad assistant for another team, Goucher College, that at the time was in our same league. So I got to work with and for Kyle Hannon and some other really good coaches. And that's sort of where I cut my teeth. I started as a defensive coordinator there. So I was there for 2 years, then moved on to Roanoke College for 2 years, where I continued as the defensive coordinator there under Bill Pilot, which is one of my transformative experiences. Had a lot of success there, learned a ton, gained a lot of confidence. And I really had the Division I itch, and Coach Stanowski at Duke welcomed me on as a volunteer assistant there. And I was one of the early wave of volunteers as like a springboard into Division I. Mm-hmm. So, unbelievably grateful for that experience. I did not know those guys before. So,
what year was that?
The way they this is 2011.
Okay.
So the 2010 Duke team was absolutely loaded. It was like an MLL team with they had some guys left over with some extra eligibility that year. So they were a really old team in 2010.
Duke was ahead of their time with the fifth years.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. So I don't know that the circumstances of those fifth years was the same, but nevertheless, that was the Duke team that finally got over the hump and won the championship and an unbelievably talented crew. And then I got there in 2011, where it was a bit of a youth movement, some talent within the ranks, but it was a really great opportunity for me to step in and see the coaching staff, where they went from having an extremely veteran group like back to a really young group. So really got dialed in with the fundamentals, like how to do a way to do everything. So I always refer that to that time period as my master's degree of lacrosse, and those guys, you know, Coach Gabrielli, Coach Caputo, Coach Sanowski, were amazing as mentors, as men. Had a wonderful year there. Started slow. Our season started slow. Ended up going to the Final Four. I coached the goalies, which I had some experience working goalie camps with Coach Pilot at Roanoke. So I had some ability to help impact there, the goalie side. And then I did a lot of the scout team work with Coach Gabrielli, which is really transformational for me as well. Cause I got to go and, you know, prepare for, I'd be a game ahead. So I'd just be cutting film for the next game and, learning a ton about why teams do certain things. So I felt like I had a pretty good feel for Division I after that experience. And then had an opportunity to go and coach the defense at Bellarmine, which was like an up-and-coming Division I program at the time, and was there for 3 years with Kevin Burns as head coach and Bill Gleason as an assistant coach. And another great experience. We had some really strong teams. We were in the top 20 for a little bit. Got to coach a bunch of Canadians, which sort of – it was my first experience with really diving into box lacrosse and seeing the benefits of it and trying to build systems around that a little bit. So I think that was sort of a precursor, maybe some foreshadowing to the future of, like, I guess where my offensive philosophy has taken me. But that was a great opportunity at a time to help build a program. And then from that, got to go to Rutgers with Coach Breck. That's when the Big Ten started lacrosse. Was my first year at Rutgers. I was hired there to be the defensive coordinator, which I was for the first year. And then after that year, I'd always wanted to coach offense, but my career had sort of carried me on the defensive path, which I also enjoyed, but I just kind of was hoping for that opportunity. And also so happened that we had a young, outstanding coach in Jesse Bernhardt on our staff. Mm. So after that first year, I took over the offense and Coach Bernhardt slid into the defensive coordinator role. And so I've coached offense ever since. So was there for 3 more years as the offensive coordinator. And then shortstop in Bellarmine, back at Bellarmine, and then ended up at Princeton as the, you know, offensive coordinator, working with Coach Madelon, Coach Hirsch, and, you know, who are friends of mine. You know, Coach Madeline and I played against each other in college. He was at Roanoke, I was at St. Mary's. So a friend of mine, we both came up coaching D3. So it was a great fit as a staff right away. And we've kept that same staff together going on year 5 here. So it's been quite the journey, but every step of the way has been, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, amazing. Not too many guys get to coach both sides of the ball, you know, as a coordinator in Division I lacrosse. And how much do you think that has helped you be an offensive coordinator, the fact that you spent so much time on the defensive side?
It's probably the most important thing. I think that experience, you know, being a defensive coordinator, learning what frustrates me, having to prepare for different things, certainly shaped my offensive philosophy. Because as soon as I got a chance to coach an offense, it was a combination of, you know, things I was comfortable with teaching, and then the things that really frustrated me as a defensive coach were some of the things I wanted to focus on trying to do. So it was invaluable experience being on both sides of the ball and being able to see both perspectives, and something to this day, I hope our guys would, you know, that I coach the offense, you know, I would hope our guys would echo that. Like, I do try to give the defensive perspective of, like, what our offense looks like to a defense and what their options are for some of their, you know, their cover, potential coverage solutions, the things I do, just always thinking both ways. My whole career. So I was pretty much half my coaching career so far was on the D end and half was on the O end. And that balance is, has really helped me.
Yeah. I think it's critical too. I think for every coach, you should aim to be just as good at coaching either side of the ball, because you should be able to, because it's also related. You know, it's not just like, if you focus too much on one side, you're missing the point with that. It's all interconnected.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about your offensive philosophy and how it's evolved.
Yeah, I think about that all the time, and it's still always evolving. And I think getting into lacrosse a little bit late, not really having some of the, like, a way to do everything, was a good thing. You know, I had some really good mentors along. Every coach I've worked for has been great. Like, I've learned so much from, but, you know, just kind of, Duke was definitely the first place where it's like, all right, like, at Division I, here's how you do things. And so that gave me this great foundation to build off of. But as rules changed and recruiting changed and the type of institutions I was at were different. You know, my philosophy evolved a little bit. And then with the box immersion, I think, you know, I think you were ahead of the, you were ahead of the curve there with your methodology with 3D. I think some people were a little bit like almost scared to try some of that stuff because it just looked and felt so different. But it had an undeniable influence. And then, you know, certainly that with more Canadians entering college lacrosse, you know, just, it just showed that there was multiple ways to do things. There was more than, you know, one or two ways to do things. And so I think, you know, watching those Canadians at Bellarmine, and then getting to Rutgers and having some really dynamic players, including a Canadian and Adam Charlambides, you know, it made sense to start utilizing those two-man games, thinking more about them, try to merge them into the offense. So I'd say it was like a little bit of a blend of things that I saw the most as a D coordinator that I was comfortable with, or what we were already doing and what my, you know, maybe my friends in coaching were doing. And then, as you know, you learn from success and from failure. I think I found my own offensive voice, you know, throughout those days in the Big Ten. And then coming to Princeton, you know, again, having some great players at Rutgers, some future pros and Jules Hennenberg and Christian Mazzone, and really talented players, you know, you can kind of do more. It's easier to try things or kind of let go of yourself a little bit and just let the players see what they can come up with. And, you know, at Princeton, had an opportunity to work with Michael Sowers for one shortened year, but got to use some of the lessons or some of the things that I felt would be really effective, leaned into them a little bit further with like the free play principles, not scripting as much, and just having that be more of the basis of your offense than just a huge playbook. And then over COVID, real silver lining in COVID was we had, I don't know, we had 14 or 15 guys enrolled in 2021, the season that the Ivy League didn't have sports. So as frustrating as it was to not have a team to compete with, we did have a group on campus every day that we practice with. So, you know, when you only have 15 guys out there, you're not doing man up, man down. You're not doing riding, clearing. You're not really doing much six on six. So it was just an opportunity to dive into skill development, like all the time. And you want it to be fun too. You know, there are a lot of rules on campus and, you know, they show up for a couple hours and you want to provide a great experience for them and also get better in the process. So that was an opportunity to really get out of myself and do almost an audit on all the things I coach and why I coach them and see if there's sort of other ways. And, you know, your JM3 platform was invaluable for that. Just different ways to do things with small groups, adding constraints, trying new things out with, you know, zero fear of failure or of wasting any time. And the skill development in that period was so obvious for some of the guys who took part in that. It would be hard for me to say that, you know, at any other time in my career, like there had been that much progress in skill development over a short period of time. So that really stood out to me. And, you know, obviously when you get a whole team back, your needs change a little bit. You know, there are, it's not just about developing the skill of small groups. You gotta hit on a lot of things, but the lessons learned from that experience really resonated with me. And I've been applying a lot of those principles, you know, really ever since, to have more of a free flowing style offense, more of a player led offense, where we're focusing more on actions, spacing, two-man game reads. We watch a lot of film, you know, risk assessment, shot selection, all that. So it's not any easier to coach, because you still need to be efficient and make great decisions and have all the things you need when you're coaching a very structured offense. Like, there's different versions of that you still need to coach free play, but I've leaned pretty hard into that style. And so far it's been pretty effective. And I think players really enjoy practicing and playing that style as well.
Yeah, man. It was fun to watch your offense in 2020 with Sowers in his last year there, averaging like 9 points a game. And it was a thing of beauty. And then you and I have had a chance to kind of catch up a fair amount over the course of time. And I think it's been really fun because I've learned about just as much from you as probably you from me. And it's been really fun to watch you then take your principles with your team and your roster at Princeton and then take it to the PLL with less practice, kind of a different sort of skill set of players. Can you talk a little bit about your principles and then how you kind of look to try to adjust them to the personnel that you have to let them play at their best, but still sort of keep a more free-flowing reads-based offense going?
Yeah, that was a really – that was what I was most maybe concerned about. It's like, what is realistic? Like, what can you carry over? You know, my our season ended in the first round of the playoffs against Penn State in a kind of a gut-wrenching loss. All credit to Penn State. What an outstanding season and program they have. But, you know, we lost a game, and but, you know, right after that, it was straight to camp. A couple days later, straight to training camp. So certainly, I guess the coaching sword was sharp from, you know, being at it every day. But as far as, like, you know, you get to the end of the season where you have all this stuff in your playbook and all these relationships with your players, and to go into a completely new environment with new rules. And right as we got to training camp, they said, okay, now when you win a faceoff, you get 32 seconds. So we had that thrown on us. So, you know, I wasn't really sure how it was going to play out, but I was also pretty confident in the style of play and having, you know, the best players in the world to take a crack at it. Like, I felt pretty good about that. But a lot of the things that we focused on was just sort of a pared down version of what we were, you know, what we were doing at Princeton. And some of the things we focused on, you know, right away were, you know, being able to, first of all, being cohesive, you know, as a unit, just having conversations with each other, what's working, what's not. I should even say, before, like, I even get into that, you know, Coach Holman really set the tone with how the cannons were going to be. You know, he did an exercise about with the team about what they wanted our identity to be. You know, what is a cannon? What do you guys want to be known for? And, you know, the things that came from them were disciplined, relentless, resilient, tough, selfless, poised, and unbreakable. All pretty good qualities, but it came from them. So that's what they wanted to be known for. And then also Coach Holman also asked the team expectations of the staff. And this is, you know, before we ever started practicing lacrosse together. And those expectations were honesty, preparation, and accountability within the team. You know, a lot of these guys had some experiences in the pros where they didn't necessarily have those things, or maybe not at the level that they did in college. So right off the bat, it's like, okay, well, be honest, you know, be prepared, which, you know, coming from college, like, hopefully we'd be able to provide a, you know, professional level of preparation. And then accountability is just making sure we address things that are happening within our roster or on the field, immediately. So, you know, going into it, like, you know, that was what was asked of us. So that's what we wanted to do. So for me, as far as the principles for that carried over right off the bat, the first time I got to talk to him, you know, one was this cohesion, being a high performance group, you know, trying to absolutely be the best and develop those bonds and relationships. But like I said, Coach Holman already had that ball rolling before we got onto a field. So we were all, you know, we all benefited from that. But as far as specific principles, one of them was in the two-man game, being the best pick setting team, or attempting to be, like, having an extremely high standard for the quality of your picks. We use the term AAA, always arrive alone. You know, you're familiar with that, obviously, you know, basketball background. It just means have some level, when you have some level of deception as the Dodger and the pick setter, it gives you the best chance to gain an advantage. It limits the defense's ability to communicate where the pick is coming from, when the pick is coming, and then to execute your coverage technique. So just something that we can easily hold accountable. We watch film. Are we setting AAA picks or not? You know, so that's something we can look to directly. One big one was ball movement. By ball movement, I mean pass the ball more than other people. It's really not anything more than that. Just be willing to move the ball. Reverse the field. Through X, across the top. Don't just take turns. When I watch a lot of PLL games, I just noticed a lot of turn taking. Like, I dodge, maybe I get defended, I throw to you, you dodge. And every person that's dodging is amazing. And the ball moves a little bit from side to side, but I didn't see a lot of intentional ball movement as a philosophy. And I didn't know if it was going to work or not. I had a couple people discourage me from that, said, like, you know, it's a matchup league. And that's what you have to spend most of your time focusing on. And I don't disagree with that, but it just feels great when you reverse the field quickly and the defense has to recover and get organized and get going. And you know, if you can draw a couple consecutive slides in a row off of ball movement, there's not a lot of defenses that can make it through that, especially in the PLL where they are professional. There is more preparation going on than I think a lot of people know, but it's just hard to slide and recover multiple times in a possession and ball movement and getting the dominoes falling off of ball movement just makes it really hard for the defense and fun for the offense. So we did just pass the ball more than a lot of other people. Shot selection was a huge one. And that was one where, you know, kind of calibrating your shot selection from college to pros is tough because in college you have so much time to get a good look. You know, if you have a talented group on offense, a lot of times you're passing up shot, like a lot of shots during your possessions to get the best one you're capable of getting, where in the pros, like, you can do that, but the clock's ticking. You're not just going against the defense. You're also going against the shot clock. So you might not be able to, you know, just look for the dunks on the crease. But that doesn't mean you have to settle for any shot you get. You know, you have more time than you think. You know, when there's 10 seconds left on a shot clock and you have a group of pro athletes, like, you can still get really good looks. So not being afraid of the shot clock, you know, and just hunting for the type of shots that go in. Hunting for efficiency is basically, you know, what we did. And then just constantly assessing risk, you know, based on the situation in the game, the clock, the 2-point line's a real game changer. Because, you know, typically again, in college, if you're up a few goals at a certain point in the game, you go into, you know, stall and win the game mode, or that is a dangerous game to play in the PLL. So just constantly assessing like the risk level of the decisions we're making. And then the last thing is, as opposed to building an enormous playbook, and we did build a decent playbook by the time it was all said and done, but as opposed to really focusing on just like putting in a bunch of plays, it was sort of putting in a few actions or a few type of offensive concepts and then moving them around on the compass. We call it compass versatility. So, you know, we have a few guys that are north-south Dodgers, you know, get the ball up top, coming hot out of the box and just blow by your guy. So, you know, when those guys are getting the ball, like, what type of spacing do we want to give them? What type of actions supplement those strengths? And then if we're going to be playing in more of an east-west, sides-based, you know, pairs-based, two-man, three-man, whatever it is, style offense, like, well, what are the setups we have for that? What are the actions? What are the players who are you know, a best fit in that style. And then kind of turning it diagonal too, you know, attacking from the low wings. And you can run a lot of the same actions that you run in the high wings. You can run them in the low wings. So as opposed to just putting in a million things and sort of tweaking the stuff we have based on our personnel and the cohesion that develops. And then having Asher Nolting, having him back there made it extremely obvious that we needed to give everybody a steady dose of Big Little, which we did.
Yeah. Pretty awesome and pretty simple. And I love how you sort of tailored it to kind of what you have. I mean, you know, John Donville brings something different than your, you know, you got, you know, two or three middies that could be these downhill guys. And it was really interesting how you blended them all with your AAA ratings. And also I noticed you guys had a lot of really good off ball actions going on, which it seems like there's, you know, we've talked a lot about this with Princeton lacrosse, but I want to hear a little bit about it with the pro lacrosse and how you sort of blended, how you got those off ball actions and were able to kind of maintain the ball movement at the same time.
At Princeton, the off ball actions, we had to be a little bit more intentional about that. I mean, that's not something that I was super fluent in coaching at first. The picking and screen, like the basketball style off ball and how you teach it. And, you know, we've all taught like plays that have screens. But you know, you see Canadians naturally do it when the ball swings from one side to another, you might kind of screen a guy. So it's hard to approach. So you know, that's always been part of the game to some extent, but like intentionally coaching it so they do it on their own at the right time and the right setting, you know, that was a work in progress with us. How much is too much? You know, when do you need to be available for ball movement as opposed to being disruptive? Like that's a constant conversation. But yeah, we do have to put in like a number of specific actions to help clarify what that looks like in hopes that it becomes more of a free play thing where it looks like we're running plays, but we might not be running plays, or we could be. But I will say the Cannons, man, as much as I'd love to take credit for all that stuff, it helps to have great players and great leaders across the board on that team to a man, extremely bought in, very humble, vulnerable in the things they feel comfortable with and the things they don't. So I think of myself as a coach, you know, an educator when it comes to the film and talking about the experiences and the things that work and don't work, but also more of, you know, especially when considering the shot clock in the PLL and in college, you're more of an architect of an environment. You're trying to create an environment for the players to do what they do best. So by talking about, you know, the AAA on ball, the two-man games, our off ball is off ball outlaws, you know, be extremely disruptive off ball. So that's another one of our principles. I didn't mention it, but it sort of goes in with the AAA thing, you know, the off ball version of it, being deceptive and being disruptive. And, you know, we did have off ball. We did have some specific actions and plays that were scripted to some degree, but if you want off ball to look really good, I also encourage you have Marcus Holman on your team and John Donville on your team and Ryan Drenner and Chris Aslanian and Matt Cavanaugh. Like that really helps. But just emphasizing it, I think we talk about it a lot. And those guys just bought into it all the way. And in the PLLs, there's some things that really don't translate. Like in college, there are ways to combat some strategies. I mean, you can really pack it in, you can zone up the backside, there's a lot of different variations of defense that can be effective depending on your opponent. Where in the PLL, there's certainly different identities and different defensive styles for sure, but you have to defend the two-point line. It's like basketball. Like you have to defend the three-point line or they're just going to rain threes on you all day long, which limits your ability to pack the paint in basketball. So similar thing in the PLL, you know, as long as a team has a couple two-point threats, and everybody does, it's not that far of a shot for pros. You have to defend out. So you can't just pack it in. So, you know, you are able to get some big advantages picking off ball, you know, like backdoor cuts and flare screens. And there's just a lot of room for that, as the paint's not typically as crowded. So the defenders aren't able to collapse as quickly on off-ball actions as sometimes in the college game. Yeah. And then just the precision of the passing, you know, the ability to shoot when covered. My jaw's on the floor. Not just the Cannons, but every team we play. Every time we're preparing for every team, your jaw's on the floor what these guys are capable of doing. But emphasizing the off-ball stuff, like just showing it in film, you're just, you know, you want to reward the habits that most represent your principles and the things you're trying to do. So it's just constantly pointing those things out. And those are things I don't really see during gameplay. You know, you're watching the ball, you're watching, you know, a certain, you know, maybe one or two things off. But you're multitasking a little, but those are things you don't see. But when you see it on film, you're like, oh, why was Marcus able to, you know, pump, hitch, get to the middle and upgrade that shot? It's because his defender was late because John Donville chipped him as he was cutting through on the backside before the ball swung across the top. So it's like these things have a kind of a compound effect on how, like when you see it rewarded, when you see those, the off-ball outlaw concept rewarded, guys just want to do it more.
Yeah. Great stuff, Mitch. So fun to listen to. And I want to dive a little deeper into the ball movement piece, because I feel like, you know, the way you talk about it and the way you're describing it, it was just amazing to watch Princeton last year when you guys ended up doing, you know, playing great offense and just sort of, you know, I say efficiency wise, you were good, but you really got good when the ball started to move even faster. And I just noticed that down the stretch of last season, and then it flowed right into the summer. And a lot of times people think about ball movement is like after you draw a slide, move the ball. But so much of the ball movement that you guys are doing in all the teams that you're coaching is spreading the defense out, creating difficult approaches, opening up opportunities for better AAAs because of it, because the more they have to run around and fly around and guard stuff, and their roles and responsibility changes with every single time the ball moves, and they get spread out. You know, they want it. Defenses want to pack it in, but they have to go play the ball. And so therefore, just moving the ball and having a feel for that. It's such an interesting thing about the feel for just when to move it. Right. I mean, it's just being a great ball mover is so important. Can you just talk about how you emphasize that and how, and particularly like last year, how you sort of got that going to take it to another level?
For starters, you just speak it into an existence. We are going to be a good passing ball movement team. That is what we are going to do. We are not going to just one at a time pull it out and go one-on-one. Of course, we're going to feature our most talented play. You know, we're going to find a way to do that, but yeah, the ball is just going to pass more. It's turn. One of the important things is like to turn down your turn to dodge. So the ball goes through X to the backside. It's like when you're supposed to dodge, everyone knows it. Maybe a pair is coming up for a pick and like, it's just the time to dodge. The rhythm says of the ball movement, pass, dodge, it's your turn. But instead of doing that, whip it one more time or set up like you're about to enter a two-man game on the high wing and just whip it to the backside. And then defensively, the two guys that were about to defend that two-man game action are temporarily not in a help position as they run back in on the backside and go. So it's like these little micro advantages that you gain from ball movement. You already said it. Every time the ball moves, it changes the defensive responsibility. And, you know, all defensive coaches want constant conversation defensively. So it's really hard to maintain constant conversation as that ball continuously moves, especially if there's some amount of deception with it too. And by that is like teasing a two-man game and then swinging it. You know, they have them in one mindset and then another instantly when that ball moves. So you're just trying to force a defender to multitask, constantly multitask. And that's what ball movement does. I mean, even its most simple form of passing the ball around in a circle does accomplish that to some degree. And then certainly when you're gaining advantages as you do it, you know, when you are drawing slides or you are, you know, getting, you know, slipping picks and gaining that quick advantage from that, you know, then the ball movement really heats up. And it just feels good to have the ball on your stick. I think most people, when they start playing lacrosse or thinking about really any sport, basketball too, you just think about having the ball. You know, you grow up in your driveway shooting hoops. It's just you and the ball shooting hoops. If you're practicing lacrosse, it's just you and the ball. So I think, you know, step one, when guys get to the college is realizing that, you know, you're going to be off ball over 80% of the time. So the game is off ball. The whole game is off ball. So you're missing the game if you only think about it with the ball. But it feels good to have the ball. It feels good to throw the ball. Having a catch is great. So I think it kind of has energy to it. And lots of basketball coaches say that. And I'm not the first lacrosse coach to say that either, but the ball has an energy to it. Just feels good. In basketball, get the bigs involved. That's how, you know, always your basketball has changed a lot. Now you got the bigs shooting from like the midcourt. But it used to be like get touches to the big guys on the post because it keeps them energized, keeps them more active. If they're down on the post all the time and they rarely ever get the ball except when, you know, it's a rebound or they're expected to score, you know, sometimes they get lazy. But if you get the ball and they pass it back out, it just creates a tempo that helps everybody, you know, flow a little bit better together.
Yeah, so great. And how much do you focus on scanning and seeing the field when you don't have the ball so that you can be in the right spot and move the ball to the next player and kind of be aware of the field? Because obviously your vision is one of the, you know, key fundamentals of the game. How do you sort of teach that and use that as a concept in your offense?
Scanning. I mean, again, that's sort of a constant challenge for this style of offense is knowing when you need to be an outlet to facilitate ball movement, when you should just stand on the wing and not cut off ball and not look to pick or screen off ball. You know, there's ways to help that, like certain coverages. Is this a quick sliding team? If this team's sliding quickly, then we probably need you out there ready to receive the ball with your hips, you know, squared down to the D. You don't want to be catching it running away from the defense. You know, or is it a team that doesn't slide, really wants to keep their matchup? So maybe you know, it's better to just kind of scramble the defense off ball and let the two-man game, the Dodger, you know, try to gain the big advantages themselves. So that's just a constant conversation. It's a gray area. I mean, the most important thing is to be available for ball movement. You know, as a Dodger, when a Dodger is slid to or has exhausted their dodge, like we expect there to be an outlet generally in front and behind. And it's not always there you know, perfectly on time the way you want it to be. But that's just something, you know, something just like shot back up, you know, when someone's coming up the hashes and about to shoot, like you need to have like that magnetic pull if you're on that backside, like, okay, is this a shot posture? And I need to get ready to run this out. And it's the same thing with ball movement. When you're looking off ball, like, all right, is this a good up? Is my teammate look like he's about to attack the middle here, knowing, you know, that what their tendencies are? Well, then maybe I need to be ready here. Or are they just setting up their two man? Do I have time to kind of exchange with somebody, cut in, screen for somebody if somebody else pops up? So it's just a general feel for it. And, you know, in the college game, you know, we have an opportunity to watch 20, 30 minutes of film every day where we can emphasize those things. If that's one of the things we value the most, and it is, then that's something we're going to show the most in film. Whereas the Canons, same idea, just things happen a little quicker. You know, there's not, you know, the concepts are not new. And it's just about just reinforcing which ones you think are most important.
Yeah. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about man up philosophies. What are your principles on man up? What do you like to try to get guys to do there?
That's interesting. Man up philosophy. A passing drill, like fireball passing drill, where we get in like 4v3. I don't even want to say, I love this passing drill so much. You get an extended 4v3. I think you called it something else, but you get in like, it's like a keep away 4v3 and you're about 15 yards apart from each other.
Crank
pass. And you just shoot, you basically just shoot the ball to each other. Yeah. Underhand, overhand, look one way, pass the other way, just like throw the ball really hard. So you learn how to throw the ball really hard from different angles. And the guys in the middle, the defenders in the middle, they're giving like a moderate effort, you know, moderate. They're going to knock down passes. They're going to move around a little bit, but you know, you're not going to have someone in your hands. It just gives you the confidence to throw hard passes, tough passes, have your stick dialed in, try some things out that if you're not ready to do it 6-on-6, like that's a safe place to try things. Whereas if you're throwing the ball underhand and it's sailing out of bounds when we're in a competitive segment, like then you're not ready to do that. So that kind of gives you an opportunity to get more comfortable doing things and just catching and throwing the ball hard. And then the value of of skip passes, you're getting, you know, seeing through the defense and, learning how to kind of look one way, look off a defender, or kind of how your pump fake actually manipulates the posture of the defender. And I just think those general ideas, like that's just a passing drill that I like, but if you apply those same ideas towards any numbers drill you do, and then applying those lessons to man up. So we run a lot of plays, but almost fewer plays and just more principles of man up and just sort of basic guide. Like there's a lot of lacrosse. I find there's a lot of guidelines. I don't have a lot of rules that guys have to follow, but there's a lot of guidelines, like generally look to do this. You know, if they're quick to pass, throw forward. If they're trying to carry with you as you carry, they're trying to stay with you a little longer, then it's better to throw back because the gap between defenders is elongated when they follow the carry, or if they're passing, the gap could be elongated in front of you. So just teaching some simple defensive concepts, but more so, you know, a lot of ball movement. Patience is a really big one. You know, like I said, our Canons man up was ridiculous and we didn't run many plays. But the main thing I found myself saying to those guys was, we are a man up. If we're a man up and we pass the ball around and move appropriately as a unit for the 30 to 60 seconds that we have, our chances of getting a great look are sky high. I think it, so it's just that. It's just realizing that if you just keep it simple and you have a basic idea of how to push and pull together, you're going to get good looks. And then we have sessions where we say, you know, we have to get the ball inside. You're adding constraints. You know, so when you're in a man up session, be like, all right, this time, whatever we're running, we have to get the ball inside before we score. So that could be a wall pass where it goes in and out, or you're looking to catch inside. And then inevitably what happens is the defense eventually picks up on that when you're doing it in practice, and then they overcover the inside, which then opens back up the skip looks that guys are, you know, more accustomed to trying to find. So just sort of the constraint, or, hey, you can't shoot until there's a skip pass. So as opposed to running plays, I'll run a lot of little actions and cycles too, like three man. A lot of coaches do this, but you just mix it in with your set looks. It's just like two man cycles, three man cycles, four man cycles on the left side, the right side, and then you mix in little plays with that. And then sometimes you have like two or three sets that you can play out of and expect to get a pretty good look. Like where, like if they shut somebody off, you're not like, what do we do? You know, you're already pretty, you're pretty organized with that.
What do you find gives you a hard time generally? And it could be, it could have something to do with what the players aren't doing, but when you feel like you're man up, you're moving it fine, you know, but sometimes, you know how you just, it just feels like, man, it's, are we even man up here? Like we're moving it well, but we're not getting great looks. You know, you see this from time to time where teams are just playing great man down. What do you, if for coaches that are listening here, what are some of the things you try to look for to try to get them to do to try to create, to try to like not allow those guys really to, I guess, to split as much, you know, and make them commit to some things so that you can have more skip passing lanes or you can have more, skip, you know, I guess the skip passing lanes is pretty much the biggest thing, but what are your thoughts on that?
Some of the stuff I've learned the hard way, like, I guess things that you have seen is shutting players off in different times. Like we, in the Final Four against Maryland, we had a 3-minute non-releasable. They had a 3-minute non-releasable penalty, and it was like our chance to get back in the game. We were down big pretty quickly, and then the game settled in, but we were down, so we had to get back in it. And so we had an opportunity there. I think we scored right away, and then we got the ball back, and then the next time they shut off one of our guys, so we weren't expecting to be shut off. So, you know, we didn't handle it really well. It was a little bit of a disjointed, awkward possession, and we didn't score from it. And so then at halftime, we were going back at, we were still man up going back into the second half. So I spent all the halftime talking about, hey, what we want to do if they shut again. And then they just go out there and they shut a different guy. So I was like, oh, well, we just talked about exactly what they're going to do if they shut Jake Stevens, but they shut Chris Brown. And so it's like, okay, it can't just be plays. It can't just be plays that you have. You have to have quick solutions that even if it's not like, you know, even if they are taking away a player that you want out there on man up, what can your guys feel great about? But I'd say that's pretty much like you just, and those are hard lessons to learn. Like you prefer to learn those in practice. But you know, sometimes, you know, someone hasn't shut you off in like 10 games and then they do it. But it's just kind of, those are, you know, you do an after action report on that game. Like that's something the next time we have guys shut off, we need to have a couple things we can snap to right away. And to your original question, you know, that's why you have a couple sets that you feel great playing out of. And if things are a little disjointed, you know, we just call it fireball. We get back to our base set and we just play fireball. And that means throw the ball hard around the perimeter, hunt for skips, you know, sometimes getting it inside. And then in fireball, there are like two or three quick hitters that they can call out or I can call out from the sideline. So I think it's like having a, you know, again, this isn't a fully evolved system. You know, I learn lessons all the time. Some coaches are really creative, man down. Sometimes things that you don't anticipate frustrating you do. But yeah, just having like a, having a couple different versions of your base set that no matter what they do, you can at least feel confident adapting to it. But I'd say like the teams that frustrate me the most man down are the teams that have great pattern recognition where like, yeah, we might be running a play you haven't seen, but you've seen ones like it and your coach has been able to kind of bucket those actions. Like, they know how to defend similar. They've seen similar things, so they defend it really well. And then the teams that stick drag, that have a great, the defenders that have a great feel for like when you're going to throw back and just put their stick in the lane. I mean, Maryland again is great at that. And maybe that's because I'm friends with Coach Bernhardt and he knows everything I want to do. Maybe that's it. But no, it's just great preparation, great fundamentals, defenses that don't overplay things. You know, they don't overplay it. They sit, they wait, they anticipate. You know, those are the ones that are frustrating, where you feel like you get a great look and then you see a stick in the lane, your guy kind of double clutches and or is too nervous to make the throw or telegraphs it. And, you know, you're getting into your play and the defense knows how you get into your play. And then they just throw up their stick and knock down your trigger pass. Like, those are really frustrating to me. So, and those are things you just got to, again, just have confidence, throw over the head. Don't, like, as soon as you stop and turtle a little bit and get, you know, and start thinking, that's when, that's when bad things happen. So another thing I just encourage you to do is early in man up, is stay nice and wide. Don't get tricked. Like the third pass press out thing, you know, the first couple passes of your man up, stay nice and wide, get a few touches, get a feel for where they're going to defend you. And then that way, you know, that way you can have a little bit more of a comfort zone. And then, you know, of course defenses can change it up, but there's nothing more frustrating than when you start man up and three passes in, they fly out and press on the ball and press adjacents and you turn the ball over. Like, that's the worst. Yeah. And the defense is hooting and hollering. And
or you just kill, get to run a play. Kill 8 seconds of your, you know, of the
yeah.
seconds you had left anyway.
Yeah. And you're running to the midline to free your hands and restart it.
To me, one of the big overall concepts in the game is deception. And I you mentioned a second ago when you talked about telegraphing a pass, but I feel like it needs to happen on nonstop, constantly. And how do you emphasize deception overall, not just on man up, but just generally speaking? You know, you talked about it, you referenced it in your AAA ratings, in your two-man game with and without the ball, your off ball stuff, but just generally speaking, how much do you emphasize deception and what are some specifics, maybe constraints that you use to try to teach that?
Well, deception is an all encompassing principle. Like, every single thing you do, and the more you watch lacrosse and basketball, really any sport, like wide receivers running routes, everything's about deception. When you add deception to anything, you know, we have a pretty talented junior attackman at Princeton, Coulter Maxey, who is very athletic. He is very tough. He does shoot the ball really well. So he has all, like, the athletic intangibles you want to have, or most of them. He's not the biggest guy in the world, but he's physical. And then what he's done is, you know, obviously he works hard in the weight room, is in our speed program, doing all that, but he's just become more and more deceptive, which means slowing down, decelerating. Everyone talks about accelerating. Decelerating is even more important, because sometimes you don't have great acceleration. That can't be part of your game. You still need to be, you know, dynamic, but some people can't just make a move and blow by somebody. But you can run, slow down, go again, and then all of a sudden that approach, you change the approach. Like, the defender takes a great approach on you, you start to dodge, you decelerate quickly and dodge again, and maybe that approach isn't where it was anymore. They can't shade to your left. They can't take away a side from you. So, you know, just understanding that whatever it is, you know, if you're going to set an off-ball screen, if you're going to set like a mumbo, like a slam screen, a down screen, you know, if you just stare at the guy and go right at him and screen, like, a lot of times they're going to see that coming a mile away. But maybe if you have your back to the guy, you see him out of your peripheral vision, and then you go screen, it's a much better screen. So I think if you sort of just even like simple deception, it's not like sorcery. They're not magic tricks. It's just simple ways to make it more difficult or to shorten the amount of time a defenseman has to make the reads that they're responsible for. So really, you can apply it to anything. Like, shooting's a big one. Like, you were very influential in my development of coaching deceptive shooting. It's like something that you know exists, but just kind of how to teach it and then starting to see it and realizing that most of the best shooters who have ever lived are all deceptive, whether they're doing it on purpose or not. It could be how they're swing. Maybe they hold their swing a little bit before they shoot. Or guys that get really good at just kind of leaning one way and shooting another way. But, you know, deception's always been there in finishing. So coaches have always taught deception when they coach finishing, which is sort of interesting. Maybe you've said this before too, but like all the different angles that you use to finish, why wouldn't you use those same angles to pass or shoot from a little bit more ranges too? you know, not like overhand shooting is very important. Overhand passing is very important. Those are, that is a, that's a skill, but not, you know, not a fundamental. Passing, shooting is a fundamental. So it's just interesting when you apply some of the same things you do in finishing to shooting from mid range, maybe you just tweak how you explain it. You get some results out of it. And then the bang for your buck, like coaching deception. If you're trying to improve a certain thing, focusing on deception is almost a shortcut. I'd say there are no shortcuts ultimately, but it can be a bit of a cheat code. You know, if you're trying to get a shooter better, if you're trying to get someone to score more goals as a shooter, focusing on deception is a surefire way to accomplish that, as opposed to velocity and accuracy, which are both extremely important, but just take a little bit longer to get a little bit better at.
Yeah. And they're not mutually exclusive, you know, so you can do it all. Yeah. The way you sort of talk about deception is like, if you add deception to it, on the flip side, if you're not being deceptive, what are you being? Then you're
predictable.
You're projecting what you're doing, and the defense will always guard everything that you do, including they will guard your fakes. They will guard where you look. I mean, just where you look. This is like one of the most mind-blowing things ever. You watch like Jeff Teat, and he's like, I marvel at how easy he makes the game look. But he just like naturally just kind of looks off where he's going. Not just, everybody knows to look off a feed, but he like looks off his dodges. He looks off his two-man game. He just looks off like literally everything he does. And, you know, or a Ryder Garnsey in the way that he uses deception. It just looks like he's shooting all the time. Ryder Garnsey, the way he cradles the ball coming up the hashes, you think he's shooting with every cradle. And it's just like this natural kind of on the run hitch, which he's learned how to draw checks, you know, to get a shot off. You know, you know, the hard part for so many kids growing up though, is that everything they're learning is in structure, and they're dodging against a corner. They're working on a particular move, and that turns into projecting that move and projecting where they're going, even on a question mark. You know, we've talked about this, like, you know, you're taught how to do a question mark and punch your hand out to the corner, and everybody knows what you're doing. You watch Rob Pinnell, he like looks to the middle as he's punching out, and he holds his look, and it just gives him separation. And it's just, it's like you said, it's an all-encompassing overall thing that it really is a cheat code. And I kind of look at, when I look at any goal scored in college against a good defense, and same in pros, there was something deceptive that occurred. It could have been a hezzy. It could have been a look off. It could have been like the off ball sort of thing, but something happened deceptively that caused a defensive error, because they're not just going to make an error if you don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, you just look at the national championship game. I mean, the way Brendan O'Neill shoots, I mean, he's been had some of that swing since he was in eighth grade, but like, it's a naturally deceptive swing. And when you put it, so, and then, you know, Jake Taylor scoring like the best twister ever in that game. Who would have thought that was going to happen? The goalie didn't think that, you know, that's even though, you know, yeah, it's just, it just shows you, like, it makes your strengths stronger. So if you're really fast, if you're like, you know, you can be a one move and go guy. And sometimes if you're really fast and one move and go and nobody slides, like, that's very effective. But if you're really fast and you're a one move and go guy and the defense knows it and they're coached up and athletically competent, like, they'll just slide to you and meet you somewhere and neutralize that aspect of your game somewhat. So, you know, it's like, even the one move and go guys that are blazing fast, if you add a little bit of deception to it, like a little slow, a little hesitation mid dodge, or, you know, pull up a little bit to have the slide guy go away and then go again. And then you're disrupting the time of the one slide, the two slide, the off ball decision making, you know, where your team is able to react, your players are able to react to your deception better than the defense is. So that's what I always say is, I wish, like, for all of our best athletes on our team, I say this to them all the time, if there's anything I could do to help their game, it would be to take away like 30% of their athleticism. Like, a speed dodger, make them just average speed. And then you have to use deception. So, you know, the guys that typically develop the quickest when it comes to, you know, adding deception are the guys that need to. Whereas it's some of the other guys who can just be effective and impactful with their gifts and their talents and, you know, where they are now. Sometimes it takes a little longer, you know, for them to really see the benefits. But once you do, you know, it's like going from, you know, standard to HD, like standard definition to high definition. You just see so many more opportunities to add it to each aspect of your game.
Yeah. The tricky part about deception, though, is that it involves vision and reading and perception, action, coupling. When you try to work and teach deception, you can't just teach fakes, you know, because it would be like teaching phrases in Spanish and then just going down on spring break to Mexico and just blurting out, you know, work. it's not really what deception is about. Deception is about it's nonverbal communication with your opponent. And it kind of is sorcery, to be honest. and even though it's not, it kind of is, because you can actually make your opponent do something that helps you with your ability to read, you know, and show your intentions as false and get them. You know, anticipation is a really big part of being a great defensive player. And therefore, it makes every great defensive player more susceptible to deception. So it's an amazing topic. On the topic though, I always really kind of looked for that when I was trying to evaluate players. You know, I was trying to see more than just the physicality. Obviously, you can see the speed, you know, from three fields away at times, but to be able to see to try to figure out what people are seeing. And I felt like deception was a pretty good canary in the coal mine for, are they really seeing this play? And I was curious how you look at that when you're recruiting at Princeton.
More and more I do. I want to be careful though, because I, you know, that style of coaching or valuing deception to a degree equal or greater than all of the other traditional things that lacrosse coaches value. You know, I don't know that enough coaches teach it or value it. So how would players do it? So some naturally do it. It's like why they're good. They're just naturally really deceptive players. And it's just how they play. We have a number of guys like that on our team who, you know, they may have been recruited because, you know, to go to your question, like I probably did want to recruit them because they were deceptive, but they're not deceptive because, you know, someone coached it. They just are. So those are, you know, those are nice to see because it fits in. You know, they're going to fit in with what you do well, or what you want to teach. But then I also don't want to hold it against guys too much. Yep. You know, some people, like, they're not really like allowed to be deceptive to some degree. Like that's not an encouraged behavior, at least the ways that I would want to do it. And then some other guys are multi-sport and they just don't. Lacrosse is just running, or like they're just running around and doing, trying to do what the coach tells them to do. So, but there's a nuance to it. Like, I know what you're asking. Like, you know, there's some people when you watch them play, like you realize it would be an uphill battle. Cause they're just not scanning. They're just not seeing the certain things. But, yeah. What I've found is when you get into an environment where, you know, the deception is rewarded, and discussed and celebrated when you do something really deceptive or well, or you show examples of players improving and having a lot more success due to the deception they've added to their game. I found that a lot of people can pick it up really quickly. So I do look for it. It's really important. You know, at a place like Princeton, you know, we do get to recruit like a lot of guys that at the age we recruit them are the most talented. So I think we do get to use that as maybe a determining factor between one player or another player. But, you know, I wouldn't rule guys out too quickly.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And it wasn't so much to rule guys out as much as just to try to see if they're seeing things, you know, because it's just, it truly is an indicator of what you're seeing. You know, just being able to fake, you know, everybody hitches and goes, everybody fakes a pass to dodge. I don't, you know, that's fine. But I just mean sort of when you kind of see that somebody is baiting a rotation and they can see, you know, they can see it. And that's how they're making their play rather than, you know, just, you know, on the skip pass stuff you were talking about, to be able to kind of start your swing, you know, if you're the top center guy and you start your swing towards the righty shooter and you change the direction of that swing because you see that guy as you're dragging it, you know, those are just some things just from a just seeing the game Because I think that because that's why I think that some people actually really do struggle with deception, because they don't act, they're not actually seeing everything that's going on. And so therefore deception doesn't really work if you don't have the vision and the feel, the perception of what's going on around you.
Yeah. So there's some really interesting cognitive things. I forgot the name of the company, but they've gotten into some of the professional sports organizations where you can actually do cognitive tests. These are not IQ tests. These are not, this is not something you can just improve on easily, but it's how your brain processes certain things, like mapping. Like if I'm dodging in the invert and I look up and I see where everybody is, and then I make a move and roll back, and then I pick my head up again. You know, some people can have a map. Like you close your eyes or you change, you look at something else, and then you look back and you have a map in your brain of where everybody was, and then you can kind of anticipate where they would then be. So that's like some people really have that skill and some don't. And you can get better at it. And that's where sometimes coaching really does help by giving like, hey, you know, look here first, look there. Like, you know, some people really need that. More than others. And then another really big one is impulse control. You know, you can do tests that show you. It's basically, I don't know how to describe it. It's years ago. It's been years since I did it, but they have like dots on a computer screen and a thing's going back and forth. And you have to hit a certain button when it's on the left side, a certain button when it's on the right side, but then it starts to get faster. And then it changes. Like when it's on the left side, you have to hit the right key. So it's all these little things. And, you know, mapping, impulse control is another one of them. You know, so those are like, so those are certain things you want to look for. Like sometimes players don't map well, like guys who don't throw skip passes typically have a hard time seeing like from the invert spot. Like when you're dodging, you roll back and they slide from the crease. If you never hit that skip, it's because you're probably having a hard time processing all the moving pieces. And then the impulse control too. So some people are like, always like, why did you throw that? Or, oh, like you didn't see that. It's like, well, maybe they did, but they just lack the connection. The connection didn't happen quick enough to say, don't do that until the ball was already out of the stick. So, you know, you just got to be mindful of the things you can coach and things maybe you can't. And I know certain baseball organizations have decided that based on the cognitive skills that they associate with baseball, they have their people that their draft prospects take this cognitive test. And if you score a certain at a certain level, like they will not draft you. There's a cutoff point where it's like, even if you mash homers, your inability to have impulse control show like that is a huge, that will be a huge preventative thing from you breaching level. You will not be able to hit a professional curveball if you lack impulse control at a certain degree. And then in football, these tests have been given to quarterbacks like the last decade or so. And the two guys, and this is, you know, again, this is from a few years ago. The two people who have had the highest scores on the cognitive test, like why are some quarterbacks better than others? Why, like, what is it? You know, we all want to think it's work ethic, and that's certainly, and God-given gifts, and those are a huge part of it, no doubt. But why is one guy just able to make those reads? And why, you know, why? Well, as it turns out, the two guys who scored the highest on that, on those tests was Drew Brees, you know, like a 5'10 quarterback or whatever he was, and Patrick Mahomes. So why are they the best? Because their brains are built to react a little quicker and see a little bit more than most people to go along with the, you know, the other gifts they have. Yeah. So it's just interesting when you kind of pair that. I don't have that technology. We don't, you know, I don't use that, but it's an interesting thing to think about. And going back to like recruiting, like it is important to try and figure those things out. Like, is this player scanning or mapping, or do they have the ability to like about to make a pass and then quickly realize that they can't and pull out of that. So just an interesting, you know, how much can you coach and then how much is innate?
Yeah. All right. Last topic for you. Can you tell us some various constraints that you've referenced them a little bit already? You know, you talked about your 4-on-3 crank passing, keep away, which is really a way to work on throwing the ball really hard in the context of some defenders and learning how to throw skips and stuff like that. What are some other constraints that you would use to try to teach some of the things that you would want? Say, you know, a constraint that you put on the team to get them to move the ball faster, or a constraint to put on the team to get them to use more deception or more hitches or more deceptive shooting? Are there things that you put into play, into drills, you know, during the course of practice that coaches might be able to take away?
Yeah, really simple ones. You know, I'd say, you know, the man up one I already mentioned, of like having to get the ball inside before you score, having to skip before you score. I mean, you can apply that to 6-on-6 too. Like the ball has to go through X before you're live. But you don't tell the defense that, but you know, you're playing, you're actively playing, but you say, hey, the ball has to go through X if you're trying to emphasize that. Or every time you go to set up a two-man game, you have to swing the ball first. You know, like your first time the offense sets up, you get it for a two-man game, swing it before you go. Or you have to run two actions before you can attack the cage or before you can shoot. So, you know, whatever that might, a double pick, a nation's action, like you have to run those, you know, before, you know, you can score from those, but you can't try to score until you've used those. Those are pretty common ones. I'd say like, so just being like, whatever you're trying to emphasize, like make that happen through, like make that happen through your constraint. You know, you have to, are we trying to focus on off ball stuff? Well, you know, all of our goals have to be assisted, or we really want to have our shots coming off of screens. And then sometimes, you know, you have to, again, or, you know, create that environment where maybe if it's 6-on-6, ones versus ones, and everyone's hooting and hollering, like, well, maybe that's not the time to do that. Maybe it's more of a small group thing. If you're doing a, you know, a 3-by, we do variations of 3-by, 4-by, 5-by, you know, and you can do those like you're in your backyard, or you can put the pads on and have it be a little bit more physical. In addition to constraints, I'd say the one thing, like philosophically, I've really gone towards that I don't think I'll ever go back to is, or go back from, is adding defenders in your position work, you know, adding an obstacle in your position work. You know, when you're doing things on air, it's not the same skill. When there's a defender there, there's a lot of studies that show that, you know, there's always decisions that are made. Your brain is, anytime you're shooting, even when you're just a catch and shoot, a time and room catching shot, like there's a defender inevitably approaching you or looking to approach you from somewhere. Your brain is processing that. There's a goalie standing there. There's knowing you don't have much time to get that off. There's the noise around you. You know, there's all these things happening. So when you're just practicing time and room shooting on your own, there's a mechanical development part to it that is important. It's not like it's a waste of time to do things. It's not like you don't have some benefit from doing things against air. But if you can add a defender, it just helps, because you might have to pass at a little bit of a different angle or shoot it a little bit before you want to, or have an opportunity to upgrade, you know, your shot. So I think just adding defenders, even if they're not, like, you know, again, just giving moderate effort. You know, the other day we did a give and go drill, and, you know, this goes back from the Cannons, where we had 7 offensive players. So we weren't doing like big shooting drills. It's 7 guys. So we did a lot of like give and go shooting, just one guy up top, one guy down low, just passing and cutting, like all types of different ways to give and go. Our guys started doing it on their own. I thought that was pretty cool. So I did that early on in fall. And then I realized, like, why don't I just add a defender? Because, you know, someone to pass around or someone to, and that defender, I told him he can do whatever he wants. He can kind of dodge the, he can cover the passer. He can cover the cutter a little bit. He can try and do both. Just add a constraint, add somebody in the way. And so even a drill as simple as that, like a give and go drill against air, you add one person, just a monkey in the middle, just making it a little bit more realistic, makes the drill so much more impactful and so much more realistic. So, you know, we've kind of talked about, like, even like the question mark stuff. Like, if you want to work on that a lot, add a dummy defender, have an O guy applying some basic pressure, or hold a coach, like holding a long pole. Like, so you're actually, you know, you're actually feeling the pressure, where you're being forced, or what you're rolling off of, or what it feels like when someone commits to your rocker step and then you get to the middle, like what that actually feels like. If you just do it against air, you're not really practicing the same skill that you would hope to utilize against the defender.
Yeah, it's so true. And therefore, anything you practice on air and try to learn on air, you're going to have to do again against people. It's kind of like every time you read a book, you'd have to like read it over again. You just wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so the difference is that if you are alone and you want to work on something, that's all you got. But if you have a team, why would you not create some decision-making? The other thing that's kind of interesting on that topic too, is that, you know, for like pros, when they're warming up for a season, they already know how to, they already know what it feels like to use a hesitation move on the island to set up their question mark. So they can do it by themselves and warm up and sharpen what they already have against a wall or against air. The difference is learning something new. And that's the beauty of changing things up and using different constraints, is that there are endless things to get better at, which is why you watch like the best players in the world. They get better. They keep getting better. They keep adding things to their games. Sometimes even when they're sort of past their prime, because that's like you said, that's when their physical action capabilities have diminished. But their cognitive abilities are getting stronger and they're figuring out, you know, like in pro basketball, these guys can keep scoring at a really high rate when they've kind of lost a step. And so in any case, it's all really interesting stuff. And Mitch, I always love talking lacrosse with you. I could make this into a 3-hour podcast with you, but we might lose everybody, including my wife who edits these. And so, we'll have to conclude here and do another one, but I absolutely love talking lax with you. Thank you so much for coming on. Good luck to the Tigers this year. And I'm sure we'll be talking lacrosse soon.
Jamie, thank you so much. You've been a huge influence on me. I love talking lacrosse with you and look forward to continuing this relationship.
Awesome, man. Have a great one.
You too, Jamie. See you.